Life is not a long, quiet river, much as we would sometimes like it to be. But Tim Watson Munro has had a life exposed to more white water than most. He's a forensic psychologist who has spent much of his professional life in deep contact with some of the very worst criminals of our times: mass murderers, sex offenders, terrorists, torturers of children. In the course of this, his own life's river has plunged over some fearsome cataracts, much of which he wrote about in his searing memoir, Dancing with Demons, last year. Now, Tim Watson Munro has a new book out, Shrink in the Clink, less a personal memoir than an examination of criminal psychopathology, the bright, the stupid, the lost, the mad, and the downright evil people who populate our jails. Tim Watson Munro, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much, Hugh. It's a pleasure to see you.
Who's the worst, nastiest criminal you've ever met?
A guy by the name of Johnny Cribb. I mean, I've seen over 20,000 people, but he sticks in my mind. He was a prisoner at Parramatta Jail, where I started 40 years ago on the 14th of August this year. And he had abducted a mother in the Hills District of Sydney with her three children. I don't want to distress the listeners, but he kept them captive for 3 days and ended up killing the lot of them. He is the closest I've come, I believe, to evil simpliciter in my career.
Because you deal with some really nasty people, and there's a really striking phrase in your book when you deal with Julian Knight, who was the Hoddle Street killer. He opened up with guns at random on people driving down a busy Melbourne street and killed, I think, in the end, 9 people. And you went to meet him, not sure who you'd find. He was a young man. I think he was only 19 years old at the time.
That's right.
And you speak of having an instant rapport with him. That seems an odd thing to have with someone who's done that.
Yeah, not as a mate, but I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know whether I'd encounter an enraged psychopath, somebody who would refuse to see me, someone who was acting out. And much to the contrary, I found this bewildered 19-year-old kid. He was almost obsequious in the way that he dealt with me. And I put that down to his military background. He'd been raised in a military home. He'd spent time, very unhappy time, really, at Duntroon, the Royal Military College. And so he stood up, he shook my hand, he almost saluted me. And so he was very willing and open to discussing what had gone on. And that was unusual, I thought. In my view, and I've said this in both books, I don't think he's the most evil, dangerous person I've encountered, not by a country mile, but the sheer kind of magnitude of what he did, his prospects of liberty, I think, are very bleak.
What made him commit a crime like that?
Frustration, rage. It was interesting. I spoke with him last year and he expressed remorse for the first time. He'd been at Duntroon. He was a kid from the wrong side of the tracks. And there was a well-documented history of him being bullied and bastardised. It culminated in him stabbing a mess sergeant at the Private Bin nightclub in Canberra. Now, to anyone, that would red flag, he is a kid in trouble, but the army, rather than getting him seen by a psychiatrist, put him in hospital. He'd injured his hand. His father was a captain in the military and he was sent back to Melbourne with no real supervision or treatment. And, you know, this anger kept festering and percolating. On the day that it happened, I mean, he'd had lunch with his grandmother, you know, just a normal lunch. He'd had a bit to drink. He'd gone home, gone to the local pub, he'd had an altercation with a publican. And the critical aspect to this, beyond obviously his psychopathology at the time, was that he had 3 high-powered weapons in the home and rounds of ammunition. And it was that point that he went out onto the grassy knoll on Hoddle Street and fired away.
You're listening to Tim Watson Munro, forensic psychologist for The Year That Made Me. We've obviously had a big national debate, really, particularly after the murder of Eurydice Dixon, but also after Jill Maher, et cetera, about the rights of women, of rights of anyone to walk wherever they want at any time, which is an undeniable right. Knowing what you know about human behaviour and often male behaviour, what have you made of that debate?
I think it's a conversation we need to have. I think men need to be more accountable for their actions. There needs to be early intervention. This is another thing I've spoken about for decades. Kids in primary school should be educated about social skills, conflict resolution, managing their anger. I'm not suggesting we turn primary schools into psychiatric wards, but it should be part of the curriculum. And we need to be putting much more in terms of financial resources into dealing with mental health in the community. It's an escalating problem, and it's refreshing to see that this is now much more publicly discussed than it was even 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
Because one of the things in reading your book is, I mean, you speak yourself of some of the people that you've dealt with. In the case, there's a guy called Peter Dupas, and you call him, in what seems to me language that goes slightly beyond the strictly clinical, you call him an abomination.
Yes.
And those abominations exist, and they're not people who observe the rights of others.
That's right. Dupas was never my client, but everyone knew about Dupas. And a close friend of mine, Richard Smith, who works in the drug and alcohol field, his partner at the time was murdered by Dupas. She worked as a psychotherapist and foolishly, with respect, worked from home, had an ad in the local newspaper, and Dupas answered it. And he went to her house and he killed her. So I had a very immediate connection with the tragic consequences of his behaviour. He's killed a lot of women, and he is an abomination. And in my view, he should never be released. I don't think it'll happen, but he's a classic example of a person who is very bad, not mad. And often people get confused by this in the community. They think, well, somebody who does this has got to be crazy. But the definition of legal insanity is much higher than that. And he doesn't have a disease of the mind beyond the fact that he's a psychopath.
This deep exposure to the worst aspects of humankind plainly must have played into your own dramas, because things spiraled out of control for you, as you described in your book, Dancing with Demons.
They did. Look, I've done my mea culpas, and Dancing with Demons is a full exploration of how my work impacted on me. I developed a severe depressive disorder. It was the high-flying 90s. I had a very high profile, and I developed a very severe addiction to cocaine. It was intense, short-lived. It was publicly exposed. There was a huge amount of opprobrium, justifiably. I'd let a lot of people down with that. Nearly 20 years ago now, it was 1999, I lost my right to practice for nearly 4 years. I worked on my recovery. And it's been onwards and upwards ever since that time. And I write about that in Dancing with Demons, my first book, and I talk about the impact psychologically on first responders in this more recent book, A Shrink in the Clink. I'm very sympathetic to police, ambulance officers, fire brigade people, nurses, anyone who deals with crime at the coalface, because like me, I think they develop symptoms of vicarious post-traumatic stress. There's a lot of drug use in the legal fraternity. I see people privately, they're struggling with their demons. And I think there needs to be more of an open conversation about that as well. One of the reasons I didn't disclose my drug use, amongst many, I mean, my thinking was clouded, was the fear of public opprobrium, which is a great irony, of course, because when it exploded, I mean, it was just a tsunami of stuff I had to deal with for many years afterwards.
Well, you've spoken and written about the dangers of drugs. You're particularly concerned about ice and the effect on people's psychology. But you also speak in this book about pornography,
yes,
and which we don't talk about a great deal in terms of deleterious effects generally on society. Why have you written so passionately about the dangers of porn?
Because it's ubiquitous. These days, the most bizarre, repulsive type of pornography is two clicks away on your computer. So children can access it. They're becoming sexually aware way too young in their lives. And people who otherwise may not have been drawn to kiddie porn, with the affluxion of time, they become desensitized to straight pornography. Pop-ups occur on their screens, and all of a sudden they're in a world of pain. And so I think it's something that needs to be talked about. It's been a growth industry for criminal lawyers and forensic psychologists, by the way. And a lot of the people that I've seen who are charged with these types of offences, I'm struck by their ordinariness. You know, they're blokes from the suburbs, they have jobs, they have wives, they have kids, and they seem to compartmentalise their addiction. They go into a sort of dissociative state in the back shed or down in the den for hours and hours and hours just looking at this material. I've seen police who are very traumatised by having to deal with this material, because when they get a brief, they have to go through every photograph. They have to determine its severity on what's called the Copine scale, ranging from the mild to the just extraordinarily nauseating. And, you know, they go home to wives and kids as well, and they're often deeply affected by it. So that's why I've written about it. I think it's important that there's a discussion about that as well.
Your new book is Shrink in the Clink. The year that made you, you say, is 1978. Why that year?
That was the year I started my career at Parramatta Jail. I was 25. I probably weighed about 30 kilograms less. I looked about 18. I can still remember walking through the gate on the first day, the smell of Lysol, you know, that strong sort of disinfectant, turbocharged, Dettol really, and the wolf whistles from the crooks, you know, saying, "Hey, baby, welcome aboard, come to my cell." But I knew I was in for a great adventure. I didn't think it would be as great as it became.
And the song, For All the Gloom, is about as cheerful a thing as you could possibly imagine. Queen.
Yes.
We're the champions.
We were the champions then. And one of the programs I set up just very quickly was with one of the prisoners. It was the concert committee. And a guy by the name of George Crawford, he organised for some of the top rock and roll bands to come into the jail each Sunday. And their performances were recorded. They donated the royalties to the International Year of the Child. And they produced an album called Canned Rock. So Parramatta Jail back in the late 70s, it was almost like a university campus. We had playwrights, musicians, people coming in who were wanting to interview people. And it was in the spirit of reform through the Nagel Royal Commission, where they said we need to make jails more open. And so it was a fabulous time to be there, quite different these days.
Queen, we are the champions. Tim Watson Munro, a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, Hugh. Great to see you.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few.
Nothing like a bit of bombast on your Sunday morning. We are the champions, Queen's big hit from the 70s. The song chosen by my guest for the year that made me, Tim Watson Munro.